Welcome to Hearing Voices from NPR. I'm Jay Allison. At our public radio website, transom.org, we try to find stories that aren't being told and voices not often heard. In this hour, we will hear the voices of Polk Street in San Francisco. Joey Plaster is an oral historian focusing on queer history in the Bay Area. He spent over a year in 2008 and 2009 gathering the stories of the Polk Street neighborhood. He talked to people on the street and alleyways, in the bars and churches, in apartments and shelters, and in the missions and the clubs.
A lot of people call it the gutter. This was the core of the party. You know, the bathhouses were here, all the nightclubs were here, all the bars were here, all the drugs were here.
Extreme freedom and extreme despair.
Polk Street will make or break you.
Joey Plaster has said that part of his motivation in recording more than 70 people on Polk Street was to reclaim a part of queer history. He writes, "The Polk Street community predates the modern gay rights movement and remains a visible manifestation of the stereotypes the movement has worked to scrub clean over the past 40 years. That is, queer people as mentally ill, criminal, licentious, and doomed to lonely lives." Joey continues, "Instead of repudiating this history, I want to embrace and learn from it." As a public historian, Joey Plaster set out to explore this neighborhood from the inside, and in the next hour you will hear a part of what he found. We should caution you that many of the stories are sexual in nature and emotionally intense. They may not be appropriate for some listeners. Here's Joey Plaster.
I came to San Francisco in part to figure out what it means to be queer. I came to what my uncle calls the land of fruit and nuts. If the famous gay Castro neighborhood was scrubbed clean and glossy, I was always more attracted to its black sheep sister, the queer world of Polk Street. It was a whole world to itself, just about 10 blocks of low-rent hotels, bars and liquor stores, all sandwiched in between the gritty Tenderloin, City Hall, and the upscale Nob Hill neighborhood. But by the time I got there, that scene was receding. Luxury condos and posh clubs were taking its place. People said gentrification was displacing the down-and-out folks who had long made Polk Street their home. Young queer activist groups held protests. Drag queens led Take Back the Polk marches. The press chimed in, some calling it a death, some a renaissance. For me, it felt like an enormous loss, like it was losing part of the history I'd come to San Francisco to claim, to become a part of. In a way, I started to think about Polk Street as this parent I never knew, now elderly and dying. And it became an obsession to save its history, its collective wisdom and secrets, before they were gone completely. Some of the stories were painful to hear. They're from people who are often out of sight and forgotten. In this hour, you won't hear a full history of the neighborhood. You'll hear stories from the extremes, about the rewards and perils of the freedom Polk Street offered. The first person I met was River Sims, the self-described punk priest of Polk Street. He was flirty at first, said I was just like one of the boys, by which he meant his congregation of the past 15 years, the kids who gather on the street, many of them drug users and sex workers. Defrocked by a mainline church, River worked independently. I got to know him over a few months, serving free dinners with him in an alley off Polk Street, handing out condoms and insulin syringes on the street together. We recorded stories in a small one-room apartment, one wall a motley collection of handmade crucifixes, another covered from floor to ceiling with framed photos of the boys. Most of them, he said, were dead. One day he motioned to a photo and told me it was his son. He said his story needed to be recorded, but it would be difficult for him to tell it, that we should record it in one sitting and never revisit it again. He lay down on his pull-out bed and closed his eyes. He started to talk as I held the microphone to his mouth.
When I was 15, my initial experience with sex was having sex with this girl under the altar of the church. And she got pregnant. And a boy was born. He was adopted into a fairly wealthy family in Portland. And his name was Zach. Well, about 14 years ago, I guess, you know, I knew I'd probably never have kids. And I've always felt rather guilty. So I found out where Zach was, and he found out he was out here on the streets here in Portland. And so I came out here, and I knew he'd be around as he's out here hustling. And I, you know, I intentionally looked for him. And I remember he came skating up and asked me for some food. That's the first time I saw him. You know, I recognized him because my parents sent me pictures. So for 8 years, he was in and out of here. He never knew who I was. He just knew I was his friend. And he would be down here working. He'd go up to Portland and work on the streets, and was into deeply into speed. As the years moved on, I watched him go from about 12 or so, 13 on the streets, to being like the typical street kid, pretty unworkable and pretty needy. And we had this, you know, relationship I have with most of the guys out here where they trusted me, depended on me. You know, it was hard watching it, watching what happened with him. But, you know, I also took care of him. And so, I mean, I had that, I did the best I could with him. I remember one time he came over to me up on speed for days, and he wanted to lay down somewhere where he could lay down, because every time he lay down at someone else's house, he'd get raped or something, usually raped. And I remember he fell asleep, and for 5 days I'd have to move him around when I had people in and out, because he was so sound asleep. And he trusted me that much. So, I mean, I remember that. You know, I remember, you know, that was, and he loved me, like a lot of these guys do. But I mean, I had my chance with him. And then about 7 years ago, I got this phone call from the police in Portland. He had used my card, and he'd also used me as his emergency contact, where he had been murdered in a drug deal. He apparently tried to steal or cheat the guy of drugs, so they gave him an overdose of speed, power pack, they call it. And then in the end, what happens, I had his body cremated and scattered his ashes in the Pioneer Square where he skated. And I had a service down here, but I had to take the summer off. Basically, it's only been the last couple of years that the grief finally subsided. And I mean, he never really knew who I was. I mean, that was part of the agreement, the adoption was until he was 21, and he wasn't 21. So I never violated that. And I felt at the time it was better to do it that way, because they had never told him he was adopted. But for me, the whole thing with Zach has been, it's always been a lot of guilt because of the way he was born. And then the guilt that I think I had in my mind, this idea I could save him when I came out here and found him. And no matter what I did, I couldn't have saved him. Even if I'd raised him, who knows? But to me, he's always been a reminder that I can't save people, that's comes from within themselves and my hope in God helping them. And I think for me, the other aspect was about 3 years ago, I received a phone call from the hospital here. And there was a guy who was dying to ask for me to hear his confession. And I didn't know who he was. I had never heard of his name, but he requested me in particular. And he was the person who had killed Zach. He wanted to tell me that. I remember I became like I drifted out of my body, like I was another person when he started telling me what had happened. I mean, the details was very painful. I mean, it's the whole description of how he died. And I think what I remember most was this guy's pain and his fear of death and his fear of what was going to happen, as he told me not only about Zach, but a lot of other things. And at that time, I thought my anger just went. I thought all I could do is hear his confession and give him the last rites, and then I buried him. I paid for his funeral. The thing was, Zach would have beaten me up. I think that was probably the most healing moments for me. It put a face on what happened to him. And I think at the time, for some reason, whatever anger I had seemed to let go, and I realized that, you know, I was a priest, and that's what I do. But more importantly is that when you get to know someone, you realize they're both victims and they're also victimizers. I see the very worst in people here. I see evil face to face. I've seen people murdered. I've seen people brutally raped. I've heard the worst stories. And yet, on the other hand, I experienced the best. And I mean, I think that's part of the mystery of life. There's no answer as to why good happens or bad happens, and that I can find both the good and the bad in anyone. I mean, that's one of my gifts, is I will see what I call the face of Jesus in each person I meet, even when they've been violent towards me, even when they killed my son. And I think that's what, you know, that's basically what I've learned.
River showed me the wood box his son used to store his drugs. He said he left it at the apartment before he was murdered. And he introduced me to a lot of kids who were just like his son. Young people had been coming to Polk Street in the Tenderloin for decades, escaping one thing or another, though that flow had slowed to a trickle in recent years. Person after person told me that the street might be harsh, but it was better than where they'd come from. At least they had each other. That was true for Alexis Miranda. I met her a few blocks down from River's apartment, at Diva's. She manages the place, California's only full-time transgender bar. Over a few months of talking with her, it became clear that it wasn't just a club. It was also a kind of community center for transgender girls escaping to the city from across the country. Some of them as far away as Latin America and Asia.
Most people that come to San Francisco, particularly at Polk Street, don't have a bond with their family, which is why they create their own. And you create your role models, they later become your parents or your family, I would say. That's the common ground there, that, you know, you're ostracized in your own family, so you come to San Francisco to be yourself. That's exactly how my story came to be. In Florida, I came into the drag community when I went to my first gay nightclub, and I was mesmerized by that, and I said, oh, I can do that. But in the straight world, or in the Latino world, Cuban specifically, my lifestyle may not exactly be welcome. I heard that it was the gay capital, so I hopped the bus, and 7 days later, I was in San Francisco. I got a job at Denny's, and then moved on to Sizzler, and on Polk Street, while I was working in the daytime, I went out at night, and I was just carousing the shows and everything, and I met this person called Lola. Lola was my drag mother here in the city. He taught me how to embellish dresses and put rhinestones on them, and I made jewelry at that time because I couldn't afford any jewelry, so I made all of my jewelry with him. And he mentored me into emceeing and how to deal with people and how to deal with audiences. So I was doing the shows for $20 a week, and I was loving it. If Lola was still alive, then I would still be her daughter. Like, my so-called grandmother, who was Lola's mother, is still alive. So I call her my grandmother because she taught Lola, Lola taught me. The first daughter I took on that I actually consider my daughter was 10 years ago. His name was Jason, and he was on drugs. At that time, she wanted to be a tranny. But her boyfriend was beating her up, and she was on the street, and she needed somewhere to go, so she came to my house. And we went through a lot of traumas and stuff. And if I wasn't there, he would have died long ago, because somebody was there to pick him up when he fell, every time he fell. You know, when I was a kid, I was told that I wasn't going to amount to anything. I was an abused child. And when you're young, they drain that into you and they push it into you. And then, you know, you come here and there's open arms without judgment. Some of the girls that I call my daughters are prostitutes. But I don't live their life for them. I just try to be there for them when they need me. Because one of the best things that I did moving to San Francisco is to live my life the way I wanted to, which means, you know, I make a living in a dress, and a lot of people like it that way, and so do I. I've been the manager of Divas now for about 6 years. If Divas was closed, transgender girls would have nowhere to go. So that's my stake on Polk Street and at Divas, is to make sure that there's a place for the girls to come to and the people who admire them and respect them. Because that's what makes Polk Street what it is. It's unique. It's family-oriented. Whether you like each other or not, it's family-oriented. Because I know the hooker on the street. I know the drug dealer on the street. I know the bar owner on the street. Everybody knows everybody. So to lose that would be, you know, it would be a shame.
Alexis was worried about her bar, and she had cause to be. At the time I was recording, a lot of the old Polk Street had already disappeared, and people were mourning for what they saw as the loss of a culture, the loss of a home.
This is Hearing Voices. Thank you. From Transom.org, this is Polk Street Stories, a history of the San Francisco neighborhood as told in interviews gathered over the course of a year by oral historian Joey Plaster.
It's sad to see that some of the hotels that used to be residential hotels that the girls could check into, they don't exist anymore.
It just seems like people are forgetting the history of what was there. I'm not saying that the street's not cleaning up, but I'm just saying the opportunities are going away for people who just come to the city trying to find themselves.
And it's not so community-oriented anymore. It's like every man for himself. But the people who've been on Polk Street for a long time, way before any of that gentrification come in, we still communicate to each other and keep each other sane.
That street, for as long as I can remember, that's always been where the boys are. You know, I was one of those boys, and I was a part of something, and I miss it a lot, you know.
Coming up, more stories about the changes on Polk Street. A warning, some of these stories are graphic and might not be appropriate for some listeners. Here's Joey Plaster.
One night I dropped in on a protest. A group of young people were gathered in front of a site that had become emblematic of change, a slick new church built on the ruins of one of the street's last working-class gay bars, called the Rendezvous. One of the demonstrators held a banner, "Don't erase our past." They blamed the new neighborhood association for the changes, a group of business people who, not coincidentally, were holding their monthly meeting just a few feet away from the demonstration, behind the church's thin glass walls. Church member Ken Tipton and Pastor Wilfried Glabek told me the church moved to Polk Street when they couldn't afford the rent elsewhere. They said they were unprepared for the neighborhood's chilly reception.
A lot of people were really scared or upset when they heard a church is coming to Polk Street.
There was a number of people in the neighborhood. Some of the businesses were a little upset, and people saying negative things about the church on the street that were reported back.
And especially when the church bought the site with the Rendezvous bar in it, they felt that we are a very fundamentalist church and that we just moved there because we hate gay people and we wanted to transform this neighborhood.
The Rendezvous was an underage hustler club, in a way. And so, yes, that no longer is an option on this corner. It's just we have gotten more compliments for that than negatives. And we've gotten so many compliments on our building here with the church. I'm trying to find out where the negative, if this is gentrification, why do so many people like that?
I remember when I saw it the very first time and I walked up Polk Street. This place was pretty dirty and graffiti on the wall, and then this one corner had a little alcove, and in this alcove were two or three homeless people sleeping. And there was a gay bar at this time, the Rendezvous bar.
We're not necessarily against any segment of the gay community. We do feel that probably the young hustlers are needing more help than they're getting from that way of life.
Over 50% of our members are gay or gay-friendly or lesbians or transgenders.
Building a new building, I guess you'd have to say we were part of an improvement. I think our church improving this area will make it better for everybody.
The former owners of the Rendezvous Bar, David Kapp and James Bialis, opened another bar, Deco, further into the Tenderloin. I stopped by on a Thursday afternoon. It's a day when a lot of the Polk Street old-timers, some of them in their 80s, made the trek for the free lunches and company.
Polk Street used to be a great place. The gay parade started on Polk Street. I avoid that street like the plague now. I don't even go up there anymore. When we got evicted, we tried to reopen Club Rendezvous. I'd say a block and a half down the street on Polk Street. And there was this huge revolt. The Merchants Association were going to fight it until death. I thought right away that they want to make Polk Street straight.
Certainly every gay bar was closing. We were like the only ones left. So when the bar closed, and especially under such awful circumstances, it just made it, here is the last stand of the gay bars on Polk Street. It's sort of like the end of Polk Street, really. It really is, to me. Dave and I had worked a long time at the Rendezvous. There were the regulars, the hustlers, the tourists, everyday people, but we all accepted each other, and I thought it was a great feeling.
I had the connection with the other business owners and all the people who lived in the neighborhood. It was just like an extended family to me.
A lot of older people lived in that neighborhood. It's an old neighborhood. And being a bartender on Polk Street, they tell me stories of how they were young. These people were fired from their jobs. They were in the military. They had to be careful. They had to be closeted to their families. So they lost their families. They had to reconnect with people in San Francisco. They had to make new families. They've been friends for a long time, and the ones that are still alive are still friends today. So they've had like 30, 40 years of friendship together in and around Polk Street bars. And of course, these kids were on the street, the hustlers. You know, when you're working there every day, you get to know them. And you know, once you got to know the person, you didn't really judge them for being what they were. We didn't allow prostitution to openly take place in the bar. So they had to be discreet. And as long as they conduct themselves like gentlemen, you know, whatever arrangements they made secretly or by themselves, it were up to them. I think the demise of the gay influence on Polk Street was a natural progression. I was just upset that when we try to hold the Club Rendezvous as one last bastion of the gay history and culture on Polk Street, that we were stamped out like that at the end. Here we are struggling to say we're not probably going to make it, but you didn't have to like step on us at the end to get us out.
We'll be back with more Polk Street stories from Transom.org. That's coming up in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to the Hearing Voices presentation of Polk Street Stories, a Transom Radio special narrated and produced by oral historian Joey Plaster.
For the older generation that gathered at Deco, these bars weren't just places to drink. They were meeting places when there weren't many other options. They were centers for activism that laid the groundwork for gay liberation and Harvey Milk and the Castro, for the organizations and politicians of today. For this older generation, it wasn't just a bar closing. It was the march of time leaving them behind. In the place of those rundown bars were opulent businesses like the Holy Grail, a restaurant erected just across the street from the new church. The owner, Miles O'Reilly, came to San Francisco during a recession in Ireland and spent $6 million on the business. He took me on a spirited tour, pointing out the imported stained glass windows, hickory pecan floors from South America, a 250-year-old Spanish chandelier. He told me everything was very different when he first arrived.
On the day that we opened up the Holy Grail, the lower end of Polk Street was rather deprived at that particular time. But to me, you know, it didn't really make any difference whether it was deprived or not, or what the, you know, they talk about, you know, lower Polk Street being very tough and very rough and a lot of gay people here. It didn't make any difference to me if there was Zulu warriors living on Polk Street. I really wanted to be over here. It just seemed to be the right thing to do. You know, in years to come, it was certainly going to come back up again, and I would want it to be a part of trying to revive the old traditions of Polk Street. I know people spat in my face when I started off here first, which were gay people. I was told that I was an overfinanced, red-headed, Irish ruffian in a pinstripe suit, which I don't own, that was trying to re-gentrify the area. When we opened up, it took off like a bat out of hell. So, through constant phone calls, constant surveillance, putting cameras out there, talking to these people in the morning that were sleeping there, and by keeping that firm handle on it and getting in touch with the city and getting in touch with the DPW, they did eventually come out and start seam cleaning the streets to keep these alleyways clean, because they were just a playground for undesirables, and that's all the alleys were being used for. But unfortunately, I think San Francisco being a safe haven for whatever type of person you are, whether an illegal alien, whatever you are, it's also a destination for a lot of unfortunate people.
Miles was one of the most loved and hated men on Polk Street. Loved by people who said he revitalized the area. Hated by some because they blamed him and other business owners for the death of the old scene. I spent days in the archives of the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgendered Historical Society, rifling through yellowing magazines from the 60s and the papers of forgotten figures. I started to trace the world of Polk Street back in time, before the Castro, before Stonewall and the modern gay movement, to the neighboring Vice District and ghetto that was part of the Tenderloin. A place of poverty and despair, but also a place where outsiders were tolerated, one of the first places where people identified publicly as queer. It was the remnants of that history I saw on Polk Street, and it's a history Cecilia Chung was part of. I met her at City Hall, where she chairs the Human Rights Commission. She wore well-tailored clothes, and she's constantly checking her iPhone, speaking at meetings, organizing for nonprofits. It's a different life from the one she knew on Polk Street, where she arrived in 1985 with two suitcases and a few hundred dollars.
I think for my parents, they were able to live with the fact that I was gay, but they didn't know how to relate to me anymore when I came out as a woman. And because of that experience, I was kicked out of my family apartment, and I was becoming homeless instantly. Being a Chinese immigrant who's queer identified, it was hard enough for me to find a place that I would feel comfortable, not to mention a place that I belong. And when I came to Polk Street, those feelings were lifted. And I felt like I've never been as free as I was at that time. I started going to the transgender bar. It was called the Motherlode. It was one of the seediest bar in the city. You know that there was a lot of wheeling and dealing happening inside and outside the bar. And I felt that I found paradise. There was a little stage at the corner of the club where the girls would just go up and parade themselves, dancing as if they were angelfish in a fishbowl and trying to attract attentions. And that's how we felt like we were sexual beings. And that's when we felt like we are important, because everyone was looking at us. That's where I was able to see my true self through other people's eyes. You know, it came with a lot of negative consequences, but it was equally fulfilling to find answers that I've been looking for all my life in that little bar. I learned to hustle like everyone else. I learned to depend on nobody but myself. And I was doing a lot of hotel hoppings. For 3 years, that's how I survived that really hard time in my life. And getting self-medicated seemed to be a necessity at that time in order to live through that. There is definitely that element of extreme freedom and extreme despair and definitely violence. I was sexually assaulted multiple times, which also involved a police officer from San Mateo County who was driving around picking up girls and threatening to arrest them if they don't give him sexual favors. And I was kidnapped by two guys and I got stabbed. And that was the darkest time in my life. I still remember testifying for both cases in court as if I was being tried. They kept questioning about my sexuality, my gender identity, and why I was doing in that neighborhood, as if I deserve that kind of consequences, being raped or being stabbed. And there was definitely no anti-discrimination law to protect the transgender community and no anti-stigma effort around the sex worker in the neighborhood. After that, I started to realize I want to help this community. I started working as a substance abuse counselor and an HIV counselor, and I got appointed to the Human Rights Commission in September of 2004. And that's what gives me hope on a daily basis, to know that I am actively helping, not judging, but actually roll up my sleeves and do something to help make people's life better, to just offer them more choices.
A lot of people told me that's why they came to Polk Street, for freedoms and opportunities they didn't find anywhere else. A man named Coy Ellison told me that he was able to survive as a teenage runaway because of the under-the-table jobs that Polk Street's bartenders and business owners gave him. When I talked with him more than 20 years later, Coy was working as the caregiver for one of those aging bartenders. Over the course of a few weeks, we talked about his life in the apartment he shared with his partner, and he revealed the surprising way he found his identity on Polk Street.
I was basically a runaway all the time that would come to San Francisco. Most places I stayed about a month, and then I get caught and shipped back, and I just kept getting sent back to an abusive household. And it was just a magical time because I was running from my past. I didn't want my parents to find me, and I figured the only way for them not to find me was to create a totally different person. I'd worked with Irish people before, and I'm Irish. And I made a fake persona saying I was an illegal Irish immigrant. So therefore, the illegal immigrant hiding was my excuse for them not to find me ever. Oh, they gobbled it up left and right. I told them I was from County Cork, and I had some family in Mayo, and that's some that I didn't get along with in Donegal up north. I'd say the first time I did it, I was about 13. I can actually say I did that off and on for about 20 years. And it was my safety net. It was the only way I could deal with the abuse and sort of dissociate from my past and try to create a better person with a better past. Well, you see, being a sexual abuse victim and your abuser being your father, well, your adopted father, all too often when you decide, oh my God, I'm gay, you worry that you're just like your father. I had to develop a different persona that didn't have anything to do with him to find my own acceptance. I just kept trying to find my way, and it seemed like the only people that were willing to help me without asking for anything degrading was on Polk. You could get paid for sweeping a sidewalk, cleaning windows, and stuff like that. The business owners actually took care of people who were willing to work. I put on the Irish accent and everything, and people were getting me jobs left and right because I was like the new thing. And most of the bartenders knew I wasn't. But they're like, okay, well, the tourists are getting a kick out of this one, so let's have him sweeping outside the front. It was my job, being the illegal Mick, basically, to transfer liquor between bars, which is illegal, grabbing one person who's being irate from one bar and kindly getting him to another bar, which went perfect into the persona of the pub-carrying Irish Mick. I never really was my own person until I created this fake person. I didn't realize that. Coy, the Irish guy, he didn't take no lip from anybody. I just know. He wasn't going to get anybody hurt, but he wasn't going to get hurt. At that point in time, they seemed to be the best qualities that I had, the safest qualities. They were strong. I was able to fight. No one was going to hurt me. The past was a lie. The accent was a lie. The person was real. You know, it wasn't until I really moved in with Sal that I started having a home instead of a place to sleep. And Polk Street introduced me to Sal. Sal is a saint. The persona was with us for 2 years. I was very untrusting and very scared. And every day I was getting closer and a bit of me was coming out. And eventually it all had to flood out, which means I had to remember everything that happened to me in the past and relive it and share it, which I did not want to do. And the fact that when I came clean with it, he forgave me. And now here I am, Coy the homosexual in a domestic partner relationship for 10 years. And Polk Street with people embracing that and also accepting the truth afterwards really helped me find and accept the person who I am. The message on Polk Street was find out who the hell you are so we can know you. And if you're trying to be someone else, at least believe in that person you're becoming.
The old Polk Street meant the freedom to reinvent yourself for people like Coy. For others, it meant the freedom to spiral downwards through depression and loneliness and drug abuse. That was visible in the people pushing shopping carts down the street, talking to themselves, sleeping on cardboard in the alleys.
This is Hearing Voices from NPR.
Some very pretty boys and some very pretty girls have become very ugly people.
But I'm still here for some reason. I figure every morning I'll wake up and open my eyes. Well, hey, that's half the battle. You know, I mean, at least I haven't done the easy thing, which is die. You know, I'm doing one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life, and that's live.
We were all teenagers. All of us were lost souls, you know. We all needed each other.
This is Polk Street Stories, a history of the Polk Street neighborhood in San Francisco, as told to producer Joey Plaster. We want to advise you that these stories may not be appropriate for some listeners. Here's Joey Plaster.
There was one guy in particular whose story I heard over and over again. He was known on the street as Corey Longseeker. I first heard a story from a 28-year-old Lutheran minister named Megan Rohr, who works with the Polk Street homeless.
The way people talked about it is Corey was the most beautiful sex worker, and people said that they thought he was the person at the time making the most money on Polk Street. Not of the business owners, but that he was the most lucrative thing going on Polk Street. Corey, I hear in his heyday, had lots of beautiful, fancy convertibles and high-class apartments on Polk Street and, you know, whatever drugs he wanted, and went from being the most beautiful gay man on Polk Street to now having a five-minute memory, having probably the decision-making skills of a fourth grader, unable to keep his room up, unable to manage money, unable to do any of that because his heartbrokenness took him to such a depressed space. And when I first started working at the Welcome Ministry, he used to have these loud yelling conversations on the sidewalk. Well, most people call it schizophrenia, believing that he was talking to people who didn't exist. But as I started listening to the conversations that Corey was having, I realized that he was having an argument with his mom. He was having the conversation of the day he came out to her. And his mom was always trying to tell him why he couldn't be gay and why it was a bad thing. And he was always trying to have the conversation that that was who he was and it was how he loved. And he just kept having the conversation over and over and over, trying to have a different result, which never happened. And it was just painful and heartbreaking to watch Corey always have these angry conversations that people thought was mental illness or thought was drugs. And it was just having a broken heart out loud in a visible place where everyone could see it. For a while, when the neighbors were getting really angry and wanted to get rid of the homeless from the area, Aaron Peskin's office would focus on who were the loudest and who were the most annoying homeless people. And for a while that was Corey because he was having his really loud yelling fights with his mom. And so the police couldn't get Corey into housing and they don't really have mental health services in the area. So they thought the best thing that they would do would be to get Corey into jail. And Corey does drugs, so they did a sting operation where they caught Corey with drugs. The problem was is that when they finally got him arrested, he was declared mentally unfit to stand trial because of his schizophrenia. And so for me, it felt like a breakthrough. I think for 4 years, I had been trying to advocate that Corey get put in the hospital or be able to get long-term treatment or to get health care from the city. And we weren't ever able to get him into anything. And when he was finally declared competent to stand trial after he had been on the medications for about 6 months, and they sent him back to San Francisco, and it was like a completely different person. Corey was so beautiful when he came back. Like, he just had the most beautiful face. He was so with it. He was able to tell these long stories and advocate for himself. But when they kicked him out of the mental hospital and sent him back to San Francisco, they didn't give him a single one of the medications they had regulated him on. And by the time I got his mental records from the hospital, he had slowly gone back into his deep funk of schizophrenia and was at a point where he wasn't willing to go back on the medications again. So it was like watching Corey emerge in this beautiful way and then to disappear in 2 months because he had just been dumped. And it's just such a sad thing to watch how this economy has unfolded around people, you know, because it really feels like a lot of the homeless who are along Polk Street are like the litter of a changing economy of looking for younger and younger people all of the time. And when someone gets too drugged up or too mentally ill to continue being a sex worker, they're just kind of stuck in this nowhere place.
I heard stories about Corey from hotel managers, from social workers and bartenders. But no source was as surprising as Dan Diaz, a conservatively dressed retired government employee. When I talked with him, he was head of the neighborhood association blamed for pushing street people out of the area. But for years after meeting Corey, Dan thought of himself as part of his surrogate family. The first time he saw Corey, Dan was looking out the window of the QT, a hustler bar at the heart of the Polk Street scene.
What I looked at, I says, can't be. What I meant by can't be is that he couldn't be part of this whole thing that was going on Polk Street in those days. He just didn't fit it, you know, what I expected someone like a hustler to look like. He was extremely clean cut. He just looked like a kid that stepped out of one of your suburban towns. He had, of course, very nice, long, blonde hair, very attractive eyes. He's about 6'2", 6'3". 190, 200 something pounds. He was just an incredible looking person. I mean, I cannot tell you, this kid, movie star written all over him. One day when I was walking on a street, he came by and said hello to me, and then we start talking. I met some of his friends and that sort of thing. And of course, a lot of them were hustling, but I didn't pick up at that time. And I don't say that because I'm being interviewed. I didn't pick up. Corey was the only person in my life at that time. I mean, he was the only person I was really interested in because he was something different. He was a person that had a creative bent, which I really admired. I loved reading stuff. He was someone I liked being around. When he was in my car, I just enjoyed being with him. Even if we weren't talking, he was just writing. I just liked him being there. It was just really a nice relationship. For me that way, I hope it was for him. But then when I found out that he was really a fixture on the street, that's the time when I started giving him a few bucks, you know, like for food or whatever it is. He, of course, living on the street would, you know, get dirty. So we had this thing where I would take him to a spa. And what he would do is go into the spa, and he just loved it in the water there. And then while he was in a spa, I took his clothes to a laundromat and washed them, dried them, and then got back to him before he got out of the spa. And I never forgot at a laundromat on Polk Street that I had put his clothes into the washer. And it was these washers where you have those big round windows, you know. And while the clothes were washing, I just happened to look at the window and a syringe came right out at the window, you know, with the suds and the clothes going around slowly. And I was just really kind of embarrassed. But it was also an interesting thing. When I was in that laundromat, a homeless lady came by and she found out I was doing Corey's clothes. And she goes, "Oh, you're an enabler." And of course, she was referring to that I was an enabler with Corey and doing things for him, giving him money and really keeping him where he's at in a way. And it was during this time that I realized and should have known that he was doing drugs all the time. And speed was the drug of his choice. he went down from a look standpoint and from how you could talk with him or not talk with him. He went down, I would say, fairly fast. He went into a lot of gibberish, what we call gibberish, or psychobabble, I think is another word we used to use for it. If a person looks at Corey today, and then if a person can remember what he looked like before, it is not the same person. The only reason now I don't talk to him, because 18 years has been a long, long time, and I do have a life, and I'm way up there in age now, and so I've got to enjoy my life. And to see him sometimes down, it hurts. And but it's a reminder to me that he's had a rough go. He's going through probably a lot of pain and all that. And people make choices. Corey made choices. And they maybe weren't good choices.
Corey was still there on the street. I saw him walking slowly through the alleyways like a ghost, sitting on the sidewalk with his head bowed. I finally walked up to him one day and introduced myself. He was surprisingly childlike. I asked to visit him, and he read me his address from the inside cover of the Bible he had with him. A few days later, I went to the hotel he lived in just off Polk Street. His door was cracked and there were cartoons playing on the television. I heard him talking with himself. When I walked in, he told me how happy he was that I was there, that someone was there. There was a sink fastened to one wall that was clogged with dirty water, and the rest of the walls were bare. I tried not to flinch when a mouse ran over my feet. I gave him the crayons and paper that Megan told me would help him focus. He sat down in his bed and started drawing a picture of a dragon while we talked.
I'm drawing a little... trying to draw a cute little pudgy dragon. Oh, I came to San Francisco because I wanted to be an artist. Ouch. Hello, hello.
I brought you a couple of smokes, one for you and one for your friend.
Oh, well, thank you. I've lived in this hotel now for a little more than 3 months. But I've seen myself as a traveler of time and space, and I've seen my little brother as a traveler of time and space, and I've been trying to get that cleared up and cleaned up. Oh, I drew it wrong. I didn't give him the monstrous teeth, so I've been having a hard time just getting them cleaned up and getting them protected, because I don't know how to bump and grind anymore. I'm disabled. I used to be able to bump and grind. And I've been having a hard time figuring out how to organize it, because that's where they were trapped as a traveler of time and space. And I don't know how to explain that part. There used to be a lot more people. We used to play guitar and sing and dance and smoke and just have a good old time. Now there's not so many people on Polk Street anymore. Makes me feel strange. Because I've been trying to protect my little self and my little brother, and I'm about 500 homicides behind, and I don't know how to bump and grind to pick up the little morsels and the pieces of the people that I like and love the way I used to know how to. So I just keep on keeping up.
As I left his room, Corey took his imaginary child by the hand and began talking with him. And I walked down the stairs into the noise and motion of Polk Street. A year after I started this project, the changes in this neighborhood were so intense it was almost impossible to recognize the old Polk Street. But like Corey, it's still there. And I think about something Cecilia told me.
It's really difficult to imagine when you get rejected by your own family, when the whole world turned their backs on you. What do you have to live for? In spite of all these challenges, they managed to find reasons to wake up and live. That's resilience. That's something you cannot take away from this community, regardless of what your belief system is. People still find a way to survive. And that's definitely what I learned from that community. You know, how to find happy moments in the darkest day.
If I came to Polk Street looking for a queer past I could claim as my own, that's what I found. People who refused to die. People who couldn't find a place for themselves in the world, but created a new one instead.
You've been listening to Polk Street Stories, produced and hosted by Joey Plaster, with help from Jay Allison and Vicky Merrick. Support for Joey Plaster's Polk Street oral history work came from the California Council for the Humanities, the Rainbow Endowment, the Hermes Foundation, and the Horizons Foundation. For their support and guidance, thanks to Martin Meeker, Rebecca Kim, and others at San Francisco's Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Historical Society. And special thanks to the more than 70 individuals who shared their stories. Their trust and belief in the Polk Street Oral History Project made it possible. This hour was brought to you by the public radio website, transom.org, where you can get the tools to tell your own story. You can read manifestos by great radio producers and find out what kind of microphone to buy. Drop by anytime, transom.org. The Transom Radio specials are produced with support from the National Endowment for the Arts, who believe a great nation deserves great art, and from the Ford Foundation at fordfoundation.org. Thanks to WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station. I'm Jay Allison from Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Thanks for listening. This is HearingVoices.com.